Good morning. We want to welcome you. As you know, this is another forum for our Curriculum Review and Design Committee. So I want to turn it over immediately to Dr. Bartelt, who is the chairman of this committee now. Dr. Bartelt.
Okay, thank you. Thanks to all of you for coming to share with us your interests, concerns, and thoughts. Let me introduce our committee, just so you know who we are. This was formulated, I think, now 3 years ago, after the faculty resolved to engage itself in a process of curriculum review. The committee consists of 7 members, 1 elected from each of the 4 departments as a departmental representative, and 3 at-large members appointed by President Johnson. The 4 departmental elected members are Andy Bacon from Practical, Quentin Wesselschmidt from Historical, Jack Preuss from Systematics, who is in Florida giving a paper today, and is certainly, he said he was reading a paper, I don't know. Did he take golf clubs along? Yeah. And myself from the Exegetical Department. The at-large members are Professor Brower, the Dean of the Chapel, Professor Oberdeck as Director of Resident Field Education, and Professor Arend as Representative at-large. Those are the 7 of us that make up the committee. Dean Hempelman was originally a member of the committee and served as chairman, but of course when he left last fall, he left the committee. Our agenda today is really to listen to you. We have had several convocations over the past few years in which we listen to student ideas and input. Do you all have a copy of the handout that was distributed through campus mail? If you do not, there are a few extras up here. Mike, could you serve as usher here? And if you need a copy of this yellow handout, raise your hand. Assuming that if some of you got it, you wouldn't all keep it. We made some extras. As pointed out in this document, we've solicited student input also through a survey instrument, through some interview groups, private conversations. And let me announce now, as I hope to remember to announce at the end of our hour, that you're welcome to speak to any of us privately in the hall, in our office, call us up, or write us a note. In fact, I've gotten several notes, a couple page typewritten suggestions already as a response to this handout on Friday from some students who said they couldn't be here this morning. So I want to invite you to follow up in whatever way appropriate. We have studied lots of things in curriculum review, and I've sort of set our eyes on the final stage of this process, which is not curriculum review, but curriculum design. And we intend to be formulating a final report to the faculty. We targeted the end of this school year, and we'll probably be making some recommendations at our faculty forum, preschool forum, which occurs in August in anticipation of the new academic year. What we want to do today is to zero in on what we think are specifically student-oriented concerns. Let me read to you a paragraph from a document that was presented to the faculty last August, which was a progress report to the faculty. This was a document that contained about 15 different topics and headings dealing with all aspects of the curriculum. Talking about, for example, the need to maintain sort of the basic integrity of the 4 disciplines, speaking of the need to integrate the disciplines, perhaps to a greater extent, speaking of the need for more spiritual and pastoral formation, speaking of all sorts of those types of things. But one of those topics was specifically entitled Responding to Changing Student Needs. And while some of these things are perhaps more peripheral to the actual curriculum, there are some crucial issues that we want to discuss with you today to make sure that we heard correctly from our student input process. The results of review indicate that a good number of student concerns do not lie just with the curriculum per se or with its objectives, but with their ability to accomplish the objectives of the curriculum within the constraint of time and of financial resources. What this paragraph is trying to say is that while there are many concerns about the actual curriculum, though that isn't predominantly our focus this morning, and I want to allow you to know that you can please raise concerns of the actual course sequencing, for example, it seemed apparent to us that many of the student concerns really boil down to issues of the proverbial time and money. Tell us if we heard you correctly. In responding to that, we went on to say, the curriculum must consider the type of student who seeks admission to the program. Today's students do not necessarily represent the type of academic background which is foundational to the curriculum, nor do his personal circumstances allow the concentration upon studies which the curriculum may assume. The student body has a wide range of different needs and additional responsibilities, especially as these pertain to family and finances. In addition, the diversity of ages and schooling background draws attention to different learning styles of students that also need to be taken into account. While not surrendering the substance of the curriculum, the design of the curriculum must recognize the academic and personal backgrounds of the students. That was our summary statement of this section. And to some degree, that is foundational for the specific recommendations that we want to consider this morning, starting with the general flow of the curriculum. And what I'm going to suggest is that we take, there are really five items on these two pages that you have before us. We want to devote no more than 10 minutes to any one of these, so we honor our hour. And we will spend just a moment introducing these, and I think the simplest way to proceed is for you just to line up at the two microphones here and express yourselves. The first topic has to do with the pre-seminary work, and I'll speak to this, especially since I deal with this in terms of first-year academic advice and also as one involved in teaching the biblical languages. What we're after here is an attempt to separate more clearly the pre-seminary work from the MDiv work. As you know, those who are making up pre-seminary predominantly language requirements are allowed to do that while they are taking MDiv courses. While this has the positive effect of making things rather flexible and allowing you to begin to take MDiv courses, even though you're still making up what are technically admission requirements, it has the disadvantage of beginning MDiv courses without the foundation of the prerequisites, which are really, if you think about this, not prerequisites just for exegetical courses, but theoretically ought to be prerequisites for the entire curriculum. Is there a way that we could clean up all the pre-seminary work and then draw a sort of a line, if you will, and begin the MDiv work? That is kind of what we're after here. Now, please tell us if you think this is a problem that needs to be addressed. We suggest that it would help in terms of integrating the entire MDiv curriculum, knowing that everybody was sort of starting at the same place. I can think of one example that came home to me this past fall in teaching the hermeneutics course, for example, where about half the students were SEM2 students because they had made up languages the previous year, and the other half were SEM1 students who came in with all their prerequisites. Some had had Systematics 1 in dealing with the doctrine of Scripture, others had not. And this makes it difficult, for an example, to teach a hermeneutics course when you really have this sort of diversity within the classroom. One way would be to teach Greek and Hebrew intensively the way we do it in summer school, but do this in the fall and then also in the winter, possibly with one other course, but probably no more than one other course. For example, a student who came needing both languages and couldn't take summer school, this is sort of the worst case scenario, would take Greek for the 11 weeks of the fall quarter, but in a sense only Greek. Maybe one other course, or if he needed to do one of the OTNT content courses, we could probably do that. Then do the same thing in winter with Hebrew, but now he'd have his languages behind him and begin MDiv courses then kind of fresh and clean in the spring. Two questions that we would raise for you to speak to. Currently, a student that needs both languages allows one to lie virtually dormant while learning the other, then may not use either for at least a quarter or a summer. Would this proposal address this concern? Please respond to that. Two, what effect would it have if a student took nothing but languages for his first two terms? Is this a bit more than some of you could bear? That's a legitimate question, all right? It's no secret that for many, if not most students, the languages are relatively difficult. And if this is all you're doing for the first two quarters here, you might feel like you're never really getting to the seminary. On the other hand, I think it would maintain the integrity of an MDiv program and make up these prerequisites in a more orderly way. The floor is yours.
Now, speaking to the language issue, and I can essentially speak from my experience, regarding issue one, I think we'll always live with the, you can do one or the other, but I think both is almost impossible.
What's both?
Hebrew and Greek at the same time.
Okay.
I think that's a necessary evil. My point is, from my experience, has anything been pursued regarding a pre-preparation by correspondence prior to so students even arriving here? Which is the method I literally fell into when I ran out of options, and I just pursued it on my own and found a correspondence course and a combination of correspondence plus tutoring. And using the network we have of the Concordias that are out there, as well as committing to the time and effort to produce our own correspondence course, which would be a tremendous front end cost, but once it's done, it could benefit us literally for decades.
I don't know if I want to respond to everything. It'll eat up too much time, but I'll speak to that only by saying that's, I think, an excellent suggestion. We used to have correspondence courses used to a greater extent and kind of moved away from that because we felt it was easier to regularize everything by doing it here. Now I think we're rethinking that, and there are correspondence courses out there. Look, in general, the more you can get done in terms of your pre-seminary work before you get here, I think we'd all agree, the better it is.
Professor Bartel, committee, I believe from speaking from my own vantage point that the intensive courses are, well, more difficult for the older student. It takes longer to get it and to maintain it. And had I not followed up my Hebrew with more Hebrew right afterwards, after going through the summer course, I would have had difficulties with it. Where the Greek, I came in the fall and started it and went through the three quarters of Greek, did well in it and enjoyed it, and it stayed. And I continue to use it. So I really like what we have at present.
Okay.
The question I had concerning the, mainly under number two would be, would coming in, and from my perspective, coming in and taking nothing but the languages that first quarter, seems to me that would end up pushing me as a second career student into a fifth year. And I guess the concern would be from a recruitment standpoint down the road, is that going to impact guys wanting to come here, especially, you know, married, wanting to get pushed into a fifth year of studies? And, you know, maybe you've addressed that already, but it looks like it would go into a fifth year with this proposal.
Theoretically, if you take 9 hours of Hebrew and one other course, you would have a 12-hour quarter in the fall or the winter while you're taking the language. So the numbers should add up the same, even though you're taking the 9 hours of Hebrew at one time rather than in three 3-hour courses. Does that make sense?
But you'd be restricted that first quarter from taking anything else that might apply toward the MDiv, is it?
Is possibly one course.
But whereas, you know, looking from my perspective, I came in, I think I was able to take two other courses that first quarter. So maybe I'm not, like I said, maybe I'm on the wrong track here, but...
Yeah, I'm just saying that the concentration of 9 hours of Hebrew in the fall has to be weighed against the fact that you're not using up 3 hours in the winter and 3 hours in the spring to take a non-MDiv course.
Okay.
I mean, the numbers should add up the same. Now, if you don't take an extra three-hour course or something, then I think you're quite right.
Okay.
And that is a concern.
Thanks.
We'll get to this point later, and that has to do with the whole academic schedule. I mean, I don't think it's any secret to anybody that summer school has become, for most students, a regular part of their seminary life. That pertains to getting it all in X number of years.
It seems to me, in my experience with my classmates, that the majority of students here are not in the system coming through the Concordia universities. And my suggestion would be, on a similar plane as that, is to get everybody on the same page as far as non-system and system people, have a first year that takes care of all the pre-sem requirements, like the Hebrew and the Greek and the content classes. Get them done in a, what would be termed a fifth year. And then everybody would be coming in fall quarter, everybody be at the same page.
Worth discussing. If I hear you correctly, you're proposing more of a formal pre-seminary year for any and all who might need this.
Right.
One concern there is the tremendous variety. Some of you need 1 3-hour course in OT content, and that's all. And you don't need a whole year to do that. Others of you may need both languages and three courses in speech. So to build a pre-sem year that works for everybody is complicated.
First, a point of clarification. If the languages are taught intensively and someone is coming in without either of the languages, did you say that the proposal is for the Greek and the Hebrew to be taught separately? Has there been any talk of teaching them concurrently?
Gable just said he didn't want to tackle
exactly.
That. Yeah.
The reason why I say this is that
he did pretty well.
Yeah. Sooner or later, we have to work in both of these languages. Sooner or later, we have to. It's unavoidable here. By teaching them concurrently, it would be spreading the time out along two quarters. Possibly both of these languages would sink in more. As it is right now, most of us are done with our textbooks in two quarters if we are taking it over the year-long program. By doing that, you would give it more time to sink in, and maybe that would be helpful with people who wouldn't benefit from a crash course. Maybe it would retain in their memories longer. Also, you would be able to compare and contrast the languages. Let's say if you're learning the Hebrew and the Greek word for love, maybe you could learn them at the same time, and it would retain better. Just an idea, thought.
How many of you would not mind learning both Greek and Hebrew at the same time, de novo? Would not mind, that would speak positively? Oh, that's interesting. I mean, as a language teacher, I've always kind of assumed, I agree with you, you need chronological time. You can't just do this well in 7 weeks. Now, as opposed to summer school, which has gone from 7 to 8 to now 9 weeks, the quarter would expand that to 11 weeks, which is at least a little better. And on the other side, I think we should consciously consider, we may talk about this yet this morning, using the languages more after you're done with the basic course, so it doesn't fall dormant. And that would reinforce and work against the problem of learning it quickly. But to learn, second point is to learn them together sounds to me like cruel and unusual punishment. But maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. Todd, we'll take these two then, and then we have to move on to the next topic.
Okay. My only concern is that the question is, what's the goal behind the languages? Is it just a hoop to jump through?
Right.
And when we compact it, it's just to make it easier to jump through? Or is it to actually use them and to learn to love them and do it in a long time? And from what I understood, it takes half the time to forget it that it took to learn it. And if we cut that to 11 weeks, then we'll be forgetting it by Christmas.
How do you follow
that? How do you follow that
I don't
one?
Know. I guess I'm just going to reinforce what Bob said earlier, not Gable. Coming through the system, we took Greek and Hebrew and sometimes Latin all at the same time, and we're here. And I guess I really agree that there should be a pre-seminary year for people who haven't come through the system, because this is an educational, higher learning institution. Pastoral ministry is a very serious commitment, and this isn't something that we just want people to come into and get out of as fast as possible, and then, like Todd said, forget everything that you learned. If that commitment is there, another year isn't really going to matter. The financial assistance is here, so it may not be that much of a strain more than another year. So I don't see any reason why we can't have a full year of Greek and Hebrew rather than just two quarters. What are they going to do that other quarter? And then as far as needing a whole year of Old Testament or New Testament or doctrine, evaluate that on the way in. Let them take their Old Testament first quarter, New Testament, you know, that way.
Seems to be both some support and disagreement for that speech. All right, we need to move on. We can always come back. I've asked Dr. Bacon to introduce the second topic of providing a focus for each of the years.
One of the considerations that we had in the committee was the concept of what is it that we are trying to accomplish in different kind of stages. And we've tried to avoid the use of the word years or year to describe those stages, but have not been very successful at that. The reason that we wanted to avoid years and use the word stages is that so many of us are entering at different times and at different levels, and so we wanted to conceptualize what would each one of these stages look like. What might we be trying to focus on as we looked at these different stages? We started out with stage number one, and we said that stage was primarily focused on dispensing information, that there is a basic amount of content that parish pastors need to know, and we considered that to be stage one. In stage two, we said, now we need to deal with that information in a little different way. We need that basic information to be extended and refined and to provide a formational structure for you as you look towards vicarage. And then the third stage that we took a look at was a stage that was post-vicarage, an attempt to begin to acquire skills that you would use as you went out into ministry. Along with each one of these stages is the concept or idea of how do you provide that content and that information to students. So as we looked at stage one, we said classes are probably going to be larger, probably a lot of emphasis upon the professor as the one who is dispensing the information. In the second stage, we said classes are still going to be somewhat large, 25, maybe 30 in a class, but there will be more interaction and more discussion with the student. And in the final year or final stage, what we call now the fourth year, there are going to be, in our concept, smaller classes, more interaction, more mentoring that would go on in that stage. Andy, do you have the questions there? We'd like to look at a number of questions in connection with this idea of forming around concepts as we move through the different stages. But before we read those questions, at the end of each stage, it was our intent to look at some kind of checkpoint for a seminarian to see, have they indeed, for example, acquired the information in stage number one? In stage number two, how successful have they acquired what we attempted to do with them in stage number two and so forth. So there would be some checkpoints for each stage.
Jump on field education as part of the package, okay? And then we'll get back to the question.
If we're able to use this framework of those terms for those three stages, how would field education experience fit into this? I think it creates some interesting possibilities. If the first stage involves informing, then we could look at field education during that first stage as an opportunity to see as many and varied ministry contexts as possible. Students could try and visit sites that are different from what we would call their home base in field education. The opportunity for multicultural experiences during the first year of field education would be possible in terms of informing. As it is right now, the situation, as you well know, is that you're at one spot and that's where you are. This might create the possibilities for more opportunity to observe different kinds of settings. Then, you see, what we're actually trying to balance here are two things: multiple experience, multicultural needs that we have to learn about the people who need to hear the gospel, and also the need to have a relationship with a supervisor that's more than just superficial. Those two things are attempting to be balanced here. So there's a home congregation to which a person's assigned, and yet a student may be absent from that congregation several times during a month in order to observe something happening someplace else. Second year, the attempt to take what's being learned and apply it. Here at the home congregation, the student would be much more involved specifically in worship leading and in preaching. There's quite variability among congregations in terms of how often that's available for students. What we'd look to is having congregations that have made themselves very open to student preaching, have more students there in order to participate, whereas congregations where it's a rare event for the student to be in the pulpit, that might be the kind of site where we'd emphasize the broad base of what's happening in that parish as an observation point for many students to pass through, rather than having one student or several there without the opportunity during that second year to gain experience. Fourth year, the integration year, is an opportunity where the student, having seen what he's able to do during vicarage, can begin to do some specialization on his own or look for areas of remediation for himself. And then with a moderate amount of guidance, design what would be a good field experience during that fourth year for himself. That is how we perceive the resident field education fitting into this kind of three-stage model.
You want to read the questions?
All right. Are larger lecture classes, especially in the first year, a fair trade-off for smaller classes later on? Are we correct in maintaining that a vicarage in the third year best meets the objectives of the flow of the curriculum? And thirdly, would some form of guided but self-directed RFE be helpful in the final year, especially as the requirements of the first year would be reduced?
With regard to the first question, I say absolutely yes. I don't see any negatives to that at all. I think that would aid the total integration of subject matter in a very positive way. The second is probably pretty controversial. I've heard people speak both sides of maintaining vicarage where it is. My understanding of my own formation and development appreciates where it is and looks forward to the opportunity to come back afterwards and integrate new information with whatever I've learned in the process of the vicarage experience. What I really like to address is the resident field education. When we got here in July of last year, the first thing that we did was to find a church home. And this appeared, in my judgment, to be the most important element in lessening the difficulty of my kids and my wife and myself leaving one church, one home, and coming to a new place. And I think that was very important to us. My concern would be if if we were allowed the opportunity to hop once in a while from an informational point of view, that that continuity of church home would be lost and would make the family's integration into the experience more difficult. The only other thing I note there is, for some of our students, it appears that the opportunity for pulpit supply is a money-making venture, and in a positive sense, as well as formational. But
I certainly benefited from that during my seminary experience.
If Field Education incorporated all 3 years of our experience here, does that remove that as a means of helping to grow while we are earning money for our family?
As I'm thinking about it, it would not necessarily do so, because the program that the student could devise could include pulpit supply. In fact, it may in fact focus directly in pulpit supply. And there again, that would not, in a fourth year setting, at least as I'm looking at it, preclude the possibility of being reimbursed for one's efforts.
I have a question about the kind of courses, the kind of curriculum that would be necessary for carrying out this sort of stage thing. If you look at the catalog, the classes that are required before vicarage tend to be mostly the kind where information is conveyed. Can you detail in a little, would give us a little more detail about the kind of changes in the classes we'd be taking or students would be taking under that? And also, in connection with that, would that probably require students who come without languages and just start on a fall to probably have to take a fifth year because of the requirements of trying to get in these information classes like hermeneutics and the isagogics in one year?
In response to your question, Joel, we are currently, each department, looking at our course offerings in light of this particular stage concept or idea. So we're right in the process of developing something in terms of these stages, and what might that look like? In response to the second part of your question, that's a detail that I'll have to really go back and research. Presuming what Dr. Bartelt talked about in number one, that will affect number two. How is that pre-seminary work going to be accomplished? Shall we come pre-seminary work deficit and do it on our campus, or just how that's going to flow? That's an undecided right now.
Can Chuck speak from, he's got a comment on systematics.
To give you one example, Joel, of how this might work, in systematics, we've been talking about this, and were we to keep our sequence of confessions in systematics, it might work out that in confessions, you would have larger lecture classes that are primarily content-oriented, and the examinations are going to be geared towards the content, if you will, either by way of standardized departmental exams at the end of the quarter or perhaps within each class. But when you get to second year, like with systematics, while we're still dealing with content, the focus is going to shift that the primary activity we'd be doing is not merely taking the exams, but working on a theological investigation project and developing your own theological method of using the scriptures, the confessions, the church fathers, and tackling a contemporary problem. So at that point, the shift in focus of the teaching has shifted from the conveying of content to you developing the skills. And then by fourth year, when we have a smaller seminar class, then you can tackle concrete, practical problems on your own, but in a theological way.
Joel, did you want to follow up with?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to the second question. It seems to me that the planned or the proposed three-stage system would actually tend to work better with a fourth-year vicarage, in that the individual students would have an opportunity to get some training and develop skills in the ministry, counseling, administration, or whatever before actually going out onto their vicarage. Maybe I would like to actually hear from a fourth-year student who's been through it to see whether the advantages of having it during the third year outweigh the disruptions to the family and the costs that are occurred by having a third-year vicarage.
I'd like to emphasize some of what Todd said as well. I don't even have children, and I'm seeing some of the stresses and some of the disruptions that a third-year vicarage is going to maintain. So I would like to emphasize, you know, if there is a possibility of being able to structure for that option, I think that would be helpful. And in regard to the resident field education, my concern is if you are doing something that is self-directed, self-guided, do you plan beforehand, say, this is sort of what the area I'm looking in, and then go through a placement type thing to try to find some place in St. Louis that would do it? Do you do that to yourself and then be involved in a kind of, well, I want to work in applications that work more in gerontology, and so does this person, and we're both fighting for the same, you know, area to work in? Or, you know, how is that going to work if people are trying to find places that fit their specific gifts? And
those are some very important concerns that you expressed there. What I would like to see is that we would actually have, what would you call it, a smorgasbord of available types of experiences right within the St. Louis area that students could draw on. We wouldn't be locked into one, two, or three different kinds of things, but just a multiplicity of offerings that students could choose. In terms of who goes where or how many students, I can't project that far into the future to see what kinds of difficulties we might encounter, but there could be some.
My concern is within the 15 hours that are allotted for resident field education a week, would we be diluting the amount of time that would be available for the home congregation, since a lot of congregations take you and drop you right into, let's say, a catechism teaching situation, a Bible teaching situation, and thereby your time is going to be very limited. And preferably then with your section B2 on the back, which talks about a four-day week, if we're going to have evening classes, that's going to reduce it even further. So where is the time going to be for doing all of these activities? And then another peripheral is that just like pastor's educator or evangelism type of things, this is probably a nuts and bolts type of thing, who's going to pay for it? Who's going to pay for us going to these other things? I mean, does your home congregation pay for the mileage, or does the SEM foot the bill for that? Who subsidizes it?
Excellent question. One that will deserve much study. In terms of the actual time commitment, maybe it isn't always the best thing for a new coming student to suddenly find himself dropped into the responsibility of teaching a confirmation class. Some students may be able to handle and do that very well. Others may find themselves floundering in that experience. So devising a program which may make that less likely to happen, I would look at as a positive. The time that would be coming at the home base parish during the first year, time there would be really quite minimal. It would be Sunday mornings, unless you were going someplace else for an observation on a Sunday morning. It's the second year where the application, the skill building needs to take place in that home congregation with many opportunities for teaching, liturgy, and preaching.
Okay, we'll take these three yet, but please make them brief or we'll run out of time.
Go ahead here.
Regarding the resident field education, I see some really strong positives, some really strong negatives. I have a really close relationship with my field ed pastor, and I could see that not being able to develop if you go to all these different places. But then again, my field ed is 45 minutes away, so I don't have the opportunity to go out there frequently because it's takes an hour and a half a day just to go. It takes even longer on an evening when you got rush hour traffic. But the biggest problem I see with it is it can be a massive administrative problem. I mean, you have 90 students a class, and they're going all over all different times, and how are you going to administer this multifaceted field education?
That's why we got Overdeck.
I have one point about the field ed, and that is, if we're going to be moving from church to church, my own personal thing is my family desires the stability of being at one place. So I'm not sure if that's really going to work. And then the other point that I have, or more it's a question, is at the end of each stage, I mentioned on the sheet that I got in the mail that there was going to be like a kind of an examination type thing at the end of each stage? Is there a process how that's going to work?
I prefer to call them learning experiences. No one has sat down and consciously fleshed that part of it out. We are attempting to look at the checkpoints, as we're calling them, but no one has fleshed out the meaning to that yet.
I'd like to comment just briefly on fourth-year field education requirements. In talking with my fellow fourth-year students, including myself, we don't like it, to be quite honest. And part of our reasons are not all good. Partly we're just lazy and we don't like doing all the stuff maybe we should be doing. But a couple of better reasons, I think, are in terms of supervisors. Coming from Vicarage, I think it would be a step backward in terms of working intensely in such a congregation as that, and then coming back with the supervisors, and a lot of fieldwork supervisors, as you had mentioned earlier, are not as quite as focused. And so I think it's almost a step backward. It could be if you focus a little more. And also, the freedom that I found this year, a couple of us students have had the opportunity to visit numerous denominations and on our Sundays and take the Lord's Supper, and I'm just kidding. But to visit other congregations has been very helpful, and I like the way we do the fourth year non-field education right now.
If a sequence of visitations at other denominations was constructed as the field education experience, would that be a possibility? I think I'm thinking of it in terms that broad of what a student could be doing during the fourth year as a possibility. But thank you. The question about supervision, that deserves a lot of thought, because I can see the point that you're making.
Moving on, adjustments to the academic schedule. Dr. Brower, number one.
I'm here to explain why the committee had no great ideas. Actually, they had some great ideas, and they worked pretty hard at it, and made a surprisingly big effort to show some adjustments to it. But at this point, we're not ready to suggest any change in the pattern of the quarters and the summer. And I think that's part of the realization of the ancient, well, I'll say it ethnically, you can count yourself as an Indian or a cowboy who sleeps outside and uses a blanket and discovers that the end where the feet are is too short. So gets out his knife and cuts the top part off and sews it on the bottom. Now it's longer. I think that's part of what we encountered, is the adjustments really didn't make a lot of difference, but you may have some better ideas.
Read the questions, Jim Ware, the mic.
Are there major disadvantages to the current system? Would using the summer as a regular required term create difficulties for students who depend on the summer employment? I remember my days, we all had to go earn money in the summer to come back in the fall. Well, I didn't really have a plan for borrowing.
Comments.
I would affirm the current system, the quarter system. With regards to improving it, I would look to standardizing or regularizing the summer quarter so that in a sense we end up with a four-quartered school year. That does not mean that we would drop the flexibility of two-week classes or month-long classes, or that we might even not cut out the break in between, because those breaks are very beneficial, and we certainly wouldn't cut out the August break, as I'm sure everybody enjoys that. But I think with the growing number of married students in second career, and looking very favorably towards a staged idea of formation of students, that a regular integration of the summer quarter into the school year could serve very positively. I think as an example of if we work with a program of, for example, fall Hebrew, winter Greek for those students who don't have it, spring hermeneutics, It works very well with what we have to have OTI, NTI in the summer. The student continues with regular stage two classes then the following year. And so I would say this is a positive thing.
Has there been any thought given to lengthening individual class periods to 55 minutes and then making the last week of the quarter a true finals week, where all you have is just a opportunity to just take your finals and study and not attend classes every day?
You're advancing the agenda to the next point. We have considered some of that, yes.
In answer to question number two, I would say absolutely yes, especially speaking as a single student. And as one who has no regular income coming in, I mean, there's some income during the school year, but it's not all that substantial. And also that would, a summer term would limit some additional summer experiences, either a summer vicarage, which I was fortunate to experience this past summer, or with your own home congregation. And
could I just ask for a show of hands, how many of you depend on the summer to work, to do something other than summer school? Just out of curiosity, I'm looking at maybe 30 to 40% of you. I think that's the question. On the one hand, the summer is a very advantageous chance, especially to make up if you've been behind because of prerequisites. But to require it removes the flexibility of it being optional. And there are some who need it optional.
Yeah, I think that making summer a regular required term would create difficulties, not just because of employment conflicts, but also summer is sometimes a time of needed intellectual recovery.
Is someone writing down all these euphemisms? These are great. Learning and what was that? Yeah.
But if you require Greek and Hebrew in the first two quarters, I think that would essentially require two or maybe even three following summers that they would have to attend. And I think you would have to adjust the classes that are offered in the summer then.
Right.
Otherwise, they would have to go another year beyond that, possibly. And one more thing, I would put in my vote for the quarter system because I think you get more diversity, and I think that diversity is needed.
Thank you.
Would the necessity or option and or option of summer classes, how would that fit in with the stages that we've just got done describing? My inclination is that with these new stages, I think maybe the necessity of summer with each individual's where they are, it may or may not even need to have summer classes at all. I'm not sure how it would fit, but have you even thought about with the new stages not even having summer school, or is that still a necessity?
Well, it's certainly a necessity for some, if not many, students.
Okay.
I'm not sure that everybody, Andy, you want to, everybody would necessarily be at the same stage at the same time. I mean, even now, your transition from SEM 1 to SEM 2 is purely based on how many credit hours, right, Gary? Credit hours you have, and that can sort of happen to you at various places in the curriculum. It's just when you cross the threshold from 39 to 40 or whatever. Anything else here? Otherwise, we need to move on.
Very quickly, it occurs to me that if we try to make the summer a full fourth quarter with a full curricular load, that would remove the professors from an opportunity to get out of here, to study, and to recuperate. I'm not trying to sound like a vacuum cleaner, but I think their break is as important as our break.
Are you writing this down, Mr. Secretary?
Yeah.
Thank you. Dr. Aaron will talk about item two, the four-day week.
Where we have not yet achieved full consensus regarding the calendar year, somewhat greater consensus has been achieved regarding the daily schedule. As you probably heard and seen, we've been talking about moving toward a four-day week. The purpose is not to provide you with a day off to do whatever you want. It's to take into account, most of all, I suppose, student needs.
There are two dimensions to it. First of all, it's a recognition that by and large our days are probably pretty fractured between chapel, between the classes spread out the day, that we generally may not have a block of 3 or 4 hours at any given time to work on a project intensively, whether it's reading or whether it's writing a sermon or whether it's writing a paper. That 1 hour blocks of time are nice to get started, but for an extended project, more difficult. So the purpose of the 4-day week was to compress the daily schedule in such a way as to provide blocks of time both for profs and students to do that work. We've toyed with either a Monday or a Wednesday. A Monday would have the advantage of, for those who are involved in field work during the weekend and haven't had a chance to perhaps get to their studies as much as they need to, Monday provides that opportunity. Wednesday would be a little more in the week, in the middle of the week, I suppose. The second reason that we had considered this, or a second dimension of it, is the courses would be compressed between approximately 8:30 and 3 o'clock to 3:30 in the day. This was to take into account that many of you have to get kids off to school or pick up kids from school if wives are working and so forth. And so we would try to put most of the classes during that time. It would necessitate, however, moving also to evening classes. And with evening classes, not simply, if I recall, not only would we have to do electives there, but occasionally some sections of required classes. Now this we thought may be somewhat appealing too, in terms of, if wives are working during the day, they'd be home in the evening, at which point someone could then go to class. It is not anticipated that everyone would be taking evening classes or that they would be taking them every quarter, but we would envision probably sometime during the year, at least one quarter, one class. In terms of the questions then, would this be a more time-efficient way of organizing the curriculum? The classes during the day would either be 2 days a week, say for an hour and a half at a time, or they could continue being 3 days a week. We've worked it out both ways. So would this help organize schedules more effectively, and would it be a little bit more time-efficient? I would also, we think, would pull the whole community together during these times more often than not, between 8:30 and 3:30, that the core curriculum classes would be offered during that time. What are the pros and cons of evening classes? And in connection with evening classes, the third question there, do you favor block classes, that if you were to have an evening class, that it take place 1 day a week? Or would you prefer that evening class spread out over 2 days a week and an hour and a half rather than a 3 hour block? And then also, would the non-day class be used for its objective in terms of doing the study, the intensive reading, the writing that needs to be accomplished? And finally, is Monday the preferred study day? Fridays have been ruled out.
Specifically regarding the study day, I'll simply share with you the unsolicited immediate reaction of my wife when she read that proposal. And she said, well, you know what that day will turn into. And I said, what? And she said, that will be the day of free daycare. Meaning that the wives will immediately jump on that. That was her reaction, just sharing her reaction. And I'm afraid that the concept of a completely open day will inevitably fall prey to economics, and that people will simply see it as, you know, they won't be able to resist the opportunity to either save money or make money because of having that much time. And, you know, how do you enforce the ideal that you're trying to promote? It's unenforceable, and I'm afraid human nature will do what human nature does.
My initial reaction is you don't want to stay home. Would that be so bad? One, it is addressing that particular need. But two, you would have to make up that time elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
in light of the idea of having evening classes and a four-day work week, if you will, has there been any discussion with extending library hours? For example, opening the library at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I would find personally that would facilitate a lot more for me to get work done.
Yeah, I don't recall that we've discussed that, but that's an excellent suggestion.
Hi, as someone who has been through the semester system at a graduate level, I valued having one day off. It was Friday, and that was the best day for me to get work done. I had a lot of papers to do as an English major, and those were the days for research, extensive research, and hours on end, which I can't do here now with field congregation down in Arnold and driving here and there and institutional and such and this. I don't get the extended block of time that I did on that one day off. And speaking also about what Bob said, but I managed to get the laundry done on Fridays and scrub the floors and stuff, which greatly improved my home life as well. So I would strongly urge to have this one day off. And since Friday's out, I guess Monday's a good day to do it.
Not yet.
Whether or not we go to a four-day week, I would ask that you look at how efficient the scheduling in and of itself is. I had four classes last quarter, and I spent from 7:30 until 12:40, but I never had, with the exception of Monday when all of my classes were scheduled, I didn't have more than two classes. But I was still here for a five-hour block. And if the classes are structured so that they can interweave into each other during the week, then you can have, during a one-hour or one-and-a-half-hour block from 9 to 10 or 9 to 10:30, you can get two classes in over the course of a week rather than having to take two full hours or 3 hours to get those two classes in.
Thank you. I would speak against it. I think lots of it depends on how you study individually and how disciplined you are in different areas, but I've experienced two quarters now. One quarter I had it where the courses were more blocked together and I thought, gee, I was going to have these greater blocks of time and I was going to get more studying done. And I found that I was so tired after having, you know, four classes in a row that I couldn't jump right back into studying and use my four-hour afternoon block as effectively as I thought I was going to. And I find that oftentimes having an hour break, and this is different from, you know, than Mike had mentioned, but sometimes I find that having an hour break in between, I can get a quick hour's worth of reading done. There's an awful lot of reading to be done, and kind of get a head start on some things, and I use that time pretty effectively just going to the library. I also am concerned about the evening hours. I live pretty far from campus, and the evenings would be more disruptive to my family than, you know, they're used to me being gone during the day from my work life. And so I just stay here till supper time and work at the library anyway, and then go back to it after the family settles down and that kind of thing. So to me, it would be hard. I think it would also be extremely hard scheduling-wise, like you said. Otherwise, the only way you'd be able to do it is by doing evening classes, and I'd find that pretty disruptive. But yeah, we have worked that out. With reference to your first point, I agree with you. After number of block classes, you're pretty tired. The difference being is you're not having the block of free time after the same day after you take all those classes.
This is a separate day.
Right.
Yeah. But it would still necessitate evening classes, though, to be able to do this?
Yes. But again, like I say, it does not mean that every student would be taking an evening class every quarter. I suspect one quarter of the year that may well happen. And then again, it's, you know, if it's a block class, it's that one day, that one evening a week. It's not as if you're coming in three evenings or four evenings.
The only other thought that I had also is that it seems like even spread over 5 days, now we seem to still have an awful lot of times when we have more than one paper or test or whatever due at the same time, and that might just make that, you know, even worse. You know.
It's 25 after 10. I'm going to ordinarily convocations close at about 10:30, or is it quarter to 11?
I'm an hour off. Is it, what happened there? Oh, like Easter Sunday, we lost. I'm going to decree that we're going to extend the time at least till 20 till. If you have other commitments, we will not be offended if you get up and leave.
I'd like to speak. I'd like to speak for having the free day. One of my concerns and question is, though, it seems that we're trying to keep on packing it down into a shorter amount of time. It used to be that, you know, we would have all the prerequisites done, and then we would be coming to seminary, but now we've kind of packed that in now to our summer and working, we're packing it in even further. I wonder what the point is in just trying to have a huge amount of courses so that you can go through them and do kind of a half-assed job in each one of them. Well, let's try to limit it a little bit, perhaps, you know, even think about not having all the number of prerequisites for getting your degree in seminary, but that way you'd actually be able to have some time to sit and think and really deliberate about the classes that you are taking. And maybe you're not taking as many of them, but hopefully the quality would improve. And for those who say that, you know, the study day would not be used very well and all that, I can understand the abuses of it, but just because it's abused by some doesn't mean that it really shouldn't be used by those who would really need it, fully enjoy it.
My experience with night classes in undergraduate is that they're long and boring, and they waste the whole evening and can't get any studying done for the next day. So I would counsel against that, but I was thinking, why not add a 3:40 class 3 days a week instead of adding a night class?
Good.
One last comment, I guess, would be in favor of night classes, and that those of us who aspire to go into the pastoral ministry are going to need to get used to having to budget evenings for meetings for the congregation. So I think a lot of it comes down to time budgeting and looking toward the vocation that we're hoping to go into, which is going to be critical as far as the time management aspect.
Okay. Are you coming up? Two more on this then.
Just a more of a, this thing's so low, more of a general observation. It seems that you seem to be insistent upon creating one product or having one method of creating that product. And no matter what we've discussed today, a good 40% are against it or for it. And perhaps the idea would be to not insist upon that one product, to allow, we have different communities here, and to try and allow some flexibility in the process to allow people to meet their individual goals and objectives. My senior partner at Field Church and I were talking about our seminary experience one day, and we have exactly opposite goals and objectives from what I can tell so far. And so what the seminary is providing to us is sort of half meets his and half meets mine, but sort of half doesn't in both senses.
Yes, I have a question regarding the four-day work week. Would it be possible with this to have a uniform agreement among the professors to have all major assignments, tests, quizzes, and papers due on Tuesdays? I mean, that would certainly take care of the economics of the situation and the efficiency of Mondays being used. Just a question.
It's already been suggested.
As long as in your parish you tell people that they can only have a funeral on Tuesday, I suppose. Item three, sort of a confessedly not clearly defined idea, but one that's trying to get at several concerns that we've observed, one of which has to do with what we might call spiritual pastoral formation, one of which has to do with helping develop a sense of unity to our student body and community here in general. There is something to be gained by sitting together in one place for at least in some regular way devoting ourselves to study of theological texts. Also getting at the question of scheduling what can become an assortment of various sort of extracurricular meetings. Thinking of the various meetings involved with placement and pre-vicarage interviews, if you're working with Dr. Schopper and some of his small groups, perhaps in a more systematic program of faculty advising and mentoring, where we actually build into the schedule an opportunity for faculty to sit with a small group of his advisees in his office and discuss theological topics. All of this has led to the proposal for a daily period. We've kind of dubbed this pastoral formation time or habitus hour or something like that, for corporate spiritual growth through scripture reading, enhancement of skills in the biblical languages, reading in the confessions, other theological literature, etc. You can read this yourself. The design here is that this would be 1 hour on a daily basis built into the schedule when everybody would participate in this, though we wouldn't all be doing the same thing on the same day. One day of the week, for example, might be devoted to all of us sitting together in one place and reading through in Greek and Hebrew the pericopes, similar to what we do on Wednesday noons here on sort of an informal basis. Another day a week might be devoted to the same sort of thing, looking closely at readings in the confessions. The idea being not only that we're devoting ourselves to appropriate texts, not only that we are doing this as a community, but we are, in a sense, modeling the sorts of things that you might carry over with you into the parish on a more disciplined basis. But on other days, this same hour could be used for some of these meetings or small group classes or work with individual faculty and that sort of thing. That's the proposal, and we welcome your comments to this thing. Our questions are, would these periods required but without major assignments or preparation and factored into the course load, perhaps 1 credit hour quarter would be given, similar maybe to the way choir works now. Would this be a burden rather than help to an already busy schedule? This is just one more thing you gotta do. Two, would students benefit from guided readings of scripture and confessions without the requirement of significant preparation or testing? I think you know what's between the lines there. Comments, please. Scott.
I love it. I think it's a great idea because I, for one, am not. I love languages so much I took them both twice. but as far as being a burden, and no more than the Torah is a burden, you know, anyway. I mean, in a good way. I mean, it is good to be there and to study the Word and the confessions is for Dr. Aaron. As far as that. The students benefiting from guided reading, even without the requirement, certainly. I mean, being somewhere where something is read and something is done, even if it is a small amount that you are gaining, is still more than if you're not there at all. So.
Thank you.
I think it's an excellent idea, and I highly encourage or highly favor the aspect of it being required. I mean, it's so heavily law-oriented. I know it sounds, you know, requiring a devotional period, but unfortunately, we're all saint and sinner alike, and myself included, I know sometimes if it's required, at least I know I'm going to be there and get what I need, whereas if it's not required, there's going to be times where we're all going to find something else that needs to be done. So I think the requiring of it is an excellent idea.
I'd like to underscore the word factored into the course load. We'd have to be reasonable in terms of what this means in terms of the credit hours you're taking. Yeah.
I'd just like to reiterate what Don was saying. I don't know how many of my brothers are like myself. Something usually takes priority over my daily readings. And having a set time required will help me personally in being able to just be able to be in the Word, having the interaction other than just myself reading it. Okay, this, you know, I understand it, but being able to get other people's perspectives from it as well, I think that would be it's a good idea. And I think also we would definitely benefit from guided readings. Again, the same thing, the interaction, the perspectives that we may not have getting from other people.
I would hope that this isn't intended to replace personal devotion time. And I'm kind of hearing, I mean, certainly difficult, but I'm hearing people suggest that, well, since I can't do my daily reading today, then I can just go to this group and it all will be well. I see this as augmenting what we individually do in our own formation. I think the big advantage of it is developing a relationship with the professors and faculty, staff, however you work that out, outside of the classroom and outside of the legalistic element of there's a grade that's going to be attached to what you say or whatever. One of my constructive criticisms about my two-year experience here so far is the lack of organized mentoring process, and I think this would take a step in the direction of building a relationship between the students and a faculty member that can help mentor them in the formation of ourselves for the future work as a pastor. So I would speak highly of doing that. I think you'd have to be very careful how you look at awarding a credit hour and how that in particular is framed, but that's functional.
What's your concern there about the credit hour? About what do we have to be careful? What this means in terms I'm not sure.
I guess as a member of choir, I'm not very satisfied with the way it's working now.
Okay.
I would like to emphasize or just throw out that would these be more devotional? Or I could see these being nothing more than just OTI or NTI extended.
What's so bad about that?
In other words, is this going to be done on like a devotional level or?
I'll respond. I guess that's something that needs to be worked out. I'll speak from a personal bias. I think we could read the pericopes similar to what we do on Wednesday noon. By the way, if we selected the pericopes a year in advance, which I think was in here somewhere in the fine print, you would be heading out of here. I mean, if you're going on vicarage next year, you'd be working on the pericopes that you might be using the following year, Ibid for fourth year. So there would be some sort of cash value to that. And it also plugs into the earlier question of maintaining the biblical languages after we've invested a fair amount of time, blood, sweat, and tears in learning them. Mark?
I just hope with this particular part of it and what we talked about just before about 4 days that we're maintaining our emphasis on our intramural schedule and that's not getting crowded out.
Write this down.
That is a concern that we want to make sure. I think a lot of guys value that time and we wouldn't want to lose that.
Fair enough.
Not to mix different questions and whatnot, but perhaps maybe vicarage first year would be a help. Because for
now,
me,
that's an idea that has not yet been.
For me, one of the lessons over vicarage was that I needed to spend time, perhaps an hour a day, looking at something that I hadn't looked at before. And as fourth year continues, I continue to use an hour per day to cover something. But to make something required kind of hints of the law where the old man rebels and the new man doesn't see the joy of it, perhaps until fourth year. That's the comment I have.
How could you not like one of these kind of periods? I mean, it's something that we need and I think we all realize is beneficial. My only concern would be that as we have many time constraints, would we find ourselves just continually flowing all the way through without having a mental break? Let's say you have a large exam at 10:15 and then you go right into something else such as this, which is a great thing, but then you've got an exam coming up at 12:40 or something and have not had an opportunity to clear your mind of what's going on and actually step in and take a look again at your notes and that type of thing and prepare for maybe a major examination. I sometimes don't go to the Greek and Hebrew feedings because I've got other things that I have to take care of and prepare for other classes that are coming up, not because I'm not prepared enough or not organized enough. It just happens to be at that time, that's the best time for me to get those things done. And that would be my only concern, that these are great, this is a super idea, but you know, where will it fit?
Okay. Any other comments? We're approaching 20 minutes till. Peter, are you coming? Anyone coming down? Fine, we'll take Bill.
After overlooking the whole thing and putting things together, I saw that this hour you scheduled here, this at point three, really has possibilities that we haven't even thought of yet. I thought about, with regard to question A1, that if I had 1 hour of Greek required, like review through the first quarter of the fall, and then be able to use that Greek right afterwards, I'd have been in a lot better shape. It seemed to me like Greek was like 2 weeks off from when it was given to me last summer. It took about 2 weeks before I really sank in with me. And it would have really helped if I would have had Hebrew in the fall and maybe Greek review along with it. And then when maybe into isagogics, the winter quarter, would really set things in order, hermeneutics in that quarter. Because now with hermeneutics, I've lost all my Greek that I had last summer. So I think it would really have helped me, anyway, with that course in Greek.
Okay.
Do it that way.
Thank you. Did you want to speak yet, Peter? Last question.
The only thing I was going to say about this this time period is I would really emphasize that it stay primarily devotional, that the there would maybe be a tendency, I read in here something about this day could be used for other things, meeting the student body and things like that, and there might be a tendency to use this period of time, since we've got a captive audience, to take care of other administrative things or let's discuss some other doctrinal issue or whatever, and I would like the emphasis to be devotional.
Thank you very much. I'll conclude just by underscoring what is at the bottom of the handout. In its review process, the CRDC has looked seriously at many other issues beyond what we've talked about here, and we continue to welcome student comments that certainly may go beyond what is here highlighted. Your attendance, comments, and support today have been sincerely appreciated, and we thank you for your interest and your help.